Now, I know that there are many of you who were not here for the first session, and I'm going to just say a couple of things about what we talked about in the first session, and then we will try to get into our case study. First of all, let me repeat what I think is the core idea of this series of four conversations. This is an idea that I did not come up with on my own. It is an idea that reaches back at least to Martin Luther. But the person I'm quoting is a theologian who early in the 20th century wrote a little book called Our Calling. And here's his important sentence. My call, or my vocation, is the form my life takes according as God organizes it for me through God's forgiving grace. Life organized around the forgiveness of sins. What I am interested in exploring with you is really how far that idea can take us, what it might mean to organize life or to live a life that is organized around the forgiveness of sins. Let me share just a few more thoughts from Einar Billing. He did all of this writing around 1909, but I think that some of these sentences are pretty remarkable. First is this sentence about the word calling or vocation itself. He said, "Calling is an everyday word with a splendor of the holy day about it. The call does not take us away from everyday duties, but more deeply into them." He went on to say that God's calling, or our vocation, disciplines us, both with its toilsomeness and its cross. But it's more than just a discipline. A vocation or a calling is the means by which I serve the neighbor, the way that the law of God gets fulfilled is through the serving of the neighbor. And vocation is the means by which that gets done, he says. But even more than that, calling or vocation contributes to community life. It is through our vocations that order, peace, and security are offered to the world. Now, Billing thought that you couldn't really talk about the idea of vocation without talking about the forgiveness of sins. You had to somehow bring those two ideas into a very integral relationship. He swiped that idea also from Martin Luther. He said, "As tightly as the petals of a rosebud adhere to a common center and radiate out like the rays of the sun from one glowing core, that is how close the relationship is between our understanding of vocation and our understanding of forgiveness. Forgiveness is the core, and vocation is but a corollary of it, or but a petal that kind of branches out or reaches out from that one core." For Billing, the forgiveness of sins was not just a mere accounting transaction that allowed God to check off and say, "All right, you've done this," or "I've done that, therefore this sin is taken care of." For Billing, forgiveness of sins was the coming of God, in which I receive all of God's fullness and God receives all of my sin. There was an exchange that took place in forgiveness. The forgiveness of sins is the mighty deed of Christ. And a person who is forgiven is surrounded by grace and is offered a free fellowship with God. So for Billing, the idea of forgiveness of sins, and because vocation is just a corollary of it, the idea of forgiveness of sins is the totality of all of the ways that God has taken in history to build God's kingdom. Forgiveness of sins is the encounter with the living God. And with it goes a liberating self-forgiveness. So those are some of the ideas that Billing tries to bring into our attention as he thinks about the idea of what our calling is. Now, yesterday I tried to move from kind of a thematic statement about vocation to an example of what it would be like to reorganize life around the forgiveness of sins. And I chose a text from St. Mark. It was the story of Jesus feeding of the 5,000, which is not a story that most of us automatically think of as an example of Jesus forgiving of sins. But as I moved into the text, I tried to show how what Jesus was up to in his interactions with the disciples and in his offering of something to the crowd was a complete reorganizing of life for that moment. And so what he did was he was interrupted by a crowd. He had compassion upon them. He taught them, and then when the disciples began to get nervous and say, "We've got to get rid of this crowd because we don't have enough food for them all to eat," Jesus begins a process of teaching and reordering. And so they look around and say, "We can't do this." His response is, "You have to feed them." And they panic. They say, "Well, it would take 200 denarii to do this. We can't accomplish that." And Jesus asks them, "Well, what do you have?" And they walk around and they find amongst themselves that they have 5 loaves and 2 fishes. And they come up to Jesus and say, "This is all we've got." And then Jesus does his remarkable reordering. Instead of saying, "My gosh, we don't have enough," and sending the crowd to fend for themselves and everybody, allowing everybody to continue to be kind of competing consumers, Jesus sits the crowd down. He gathers them into small groups. He creates a community rather than just a mass. And then he takes the little bit that they have and he holds it up. He offers it to God. And then he stands there with tremendous courage in front of that crowd of 5,000 and offers it to them. And the marvel is that as he offers, something is released. And of course, we don't know what it is that's released. That's not described in the gospel. And I told you how a friend of mine interprets this. He says, Parker Palmer, says that what was released was that all those folks who came out there may have had food with them. And they may have had a submarine sandwich under their robe or something like that. And that what happens is that as Jesus creates community and that as he offers all that they have, all that he and his disciples have, and just says, "Here it is," that maybe some of those folks begin to pull those submarine sandwiches out and then a cheeseburger and then something else. And before you know it, there's a great act of sharing and community and a reordering of life that goes on. We're told that at the end of the incident, there's food left over and that everyone is satisfied. And what I wanted to do with that story is to hold it up not simply as a miracle story, but as an exhibit of one way in which Jesus was doing his one work. His ministry from beginning to end was one of reordering life around the forgiveness of sins. He did it when he ate with people. He did it when he helped the people who were ill, when he cured, when he raised the dead, and above all, when he went to the cross. But here you get an example of when Jesus, with food, reorders life. And he moves people from an economics of scarcity, where everybody is hiding and hoarding their little bit, to an experience of abundance, where there is more than enough. And when the crowd goes away, they go away having been transformed. Now, what I would like to do today is see if that idea of reorganizing life around the forgiveness of sins has any modern usefulness whatsoever. I think that what I was trying to do yesterday was to show how in that one miracle account, the law of God was powerfully at work. How Jesus was exposing the deadly ways in which people had organized their own lives and the way that they thought about life, and their need for a better way. And how, instead of reaching out for a better way, how when they get frightened, they pull in and they try to protect themselves and begin to self-serve above all. But also in that text, there is a remarkable instance of gospel, in that what Jesus does is he offers an abundance that the crowd could not have on its own. And out of that abundance, he releases something in the crowd, and he opens up a new way for them to be. Now what I want to suggest to you is that our calling is to do that kind of reshaping and reorganizing. And so I thought a way to see whether that has any usefulness or relevance to our modern situation was to do a case study. And I've distributed this at the end of the last session. Some of you were not there, and so I do have copies if anybody needs a copy. Somebody back there, one or two? Anybody else?
Jim, would you describe what your definition, as you're using it here, is of sins and of forgiveness?
Well, I think for me, sin is bigger and forgiveness is bigger than I think our common usage.
So,
I think sin is not just the wrong things that I get caught doing or that I recognize doing, but it's being caught up in a web of brokenness. And that brokenness manifests itself in all sorts of ways. It manifests itself in my acts of self-protection. It manifests itself in my acts of self-justifying. It can manifest itself even in acts of superheroic attempts to be good and to do right and to care. But there's a sense in which there's a curve in self that is at the problem here. That selves are not oriented the way they ought to be. And therefore, forgiveness is an address to all of those things and to many more manifestations of it. But it's being finally out of the right relationship with God, out of the right relationship with the neighbor. And that what I'm trying to get at here is that our vocation is participating in the reordering, the reshaping, and that wherever that goes on, where that reordering really takes place, where God and sinner and neighbor are brought into right relationship, that's vocation, that's reordering.
And so forgiveness, is what aspect of that process?
Well, forgiveness is, I think, it's Jesus' fundamental offering of himself. It's an offering of a life to the world that is dying. It is not simply checking off something on a list and balancing good and evil, mm-hmm. but it's an overcoming. It's a new creation. It's a gift of incredible acceptance. that you can stand in front of a crowd with very little to offer, but yet something can be made of it. You can stand there looking very bad and very weak, and yet there's a yes said to you.
That's great. Can I offer something etymologically that substantiates that? The major interpretation of the word sin, if you go back far enough, is missing the mark. It's basically getting off track. Not a punishable offense, but just straying. And repentance, R-E is to go back, repent. It's having to do with fire, and it's kind of lengthy, but the idea of repentance is going back and trying again. Not having this self-flagellation or something to make up for it, but to do it again and try again until you do it right. And forgiveness is to, well, give means to give differently. You give for something. So what you're actually doing, instead of saying, well, you did something bad and wrong, A Course in Miracles talks about this at length. Instead of saying you did something bad and wrong, I'm better than you are, and I'll forgive you because, you know, I'm better than you are, but I'll condescend to say it's okay, you know, and we'll forgive you for that. But to perceive it differently. So what you're doing is you're giving this person an opportunity to start again, to repent, and to just encourage them to come back and just, like you would with a child, to say, well, yeah, you strayed, but you're back here, let's try it again.
I think what Jesus was doing in that encounter with those people was he was both showing them how broken and curved in and how hopeless they were, but he was also not simply sitting back and saying, you folks start over, you've got it wrong. There is in his action a opening of an alternative way of being and an offer of it to them. And what we see in the account is that that had an impact on those people. It says that they went away satisfied. They were in, and I guess I would have to think it, that point in Jesus' ministry, they may not have been satisfied forever, but they were for that moment right. And so it's God's making right, God's offering a different way to see yourself because God sees you differently. I'd love if anybody else wants to comment about that. The topic, forgiveness of sins, is one that we can't talk about enough. Please.
I have a sense that one of the results of forgiveness is restoration, and restoration of relationships, restoration of something that was broken, that we can't see how to put it back together ourselves, that newness gets put together for you.
Well, I think I agree with you that there is restoration, but what I'm struck by, just I'm trying to stay within the framework of that text for as much as we can here, what I'm struck by is that there was also new relationships formed. My sense about that crowd was that it was a mass, you know, it wasn't everybody in the right kind of relationship at all, and that what Jesus does as that account unfolds is he creates a new way for them to be with each other. So there's both a restoring, but there's also the gift of something radically new that goes on. And all of that, somehow, the word forgiveness tries to embrace. I think we tend to shrink forgiveness to being, well, when I do something wrong, then I need something to kind of compensate for the wrong. But all of the new creativity that is a part of forgiveness, I think we tend to kind of leave on the sidelines or lose sight of. And I think but what Billing is trying to help us see and what Luther was trying to see was how big a thing forgiveness really is. This is the creation of something, of a whole new world, of a whole new way of being, of a whole new peoplehood.
Talked about newness. It strikes me that to use forgiveness or sin to talk about vocation we need to talk not just about forgiveness of sins, but forgiveness of the state of sin, which is so often what limits us, and we need release from in order precisely to serve. Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's what I, in the longer discussion we had about the text, I was trying to make a context, a contrast, excuse me, between an economics of scarcity and an economics of abundance. There's something about how we humans are. This is what, you know, in Lutheran language we call original sin, that we are, we approach life as if there was not enough for us, not enough of everything. And so we hoard, we protect, we pretend, we do all the things that are destructive of other people and of right relationships. And what Jesus was up to in this miracle account and in all of the other things that he was doing that the Gospels testify to was offering not a revision of the economics of scarcity, not straightening that out a little bit, but an incredible abundance that would allow one to take what one had and simply give it away, not knowing how it was all going to come out. Anyone else want to? Edward.
It's important, I think, for us to hear what you're saying with this contrast between scarcity and abundance, that those are, if you will, faith commitments, each one of them. They're not easily documentable. Although now in our day we think it's more documentable that we really live in a scarcity planet with a huge population. But even that is still a faith, a belief.
That's right.
And Jesus, as you're saying, says, well, if God is really God, and if it's God's world, and we are God's people, all of us, even those who aren't necessarily Christ connected, then it makes as good a sense to believe in, to trust there's enough in the world to go around. There is enough. But it's a belief.
That's right. And then to live according to that belief. And what happens then is, this is the idea of vocation that we're trying to comprehend here, is that I begin to live my life, and as that means in the transactions with all the people that I come in contact with, I begin to live as if that's true. And as I live as if that's true, it becomes true. Okay, and so that belief begins to have a rippling out. And that's how vocation proceeds. So vocation here is not simply a synonym for the world of work or something like that, but vocation is this sphere that gets opened up when one experiences that abundance and then begins to, because of the release that that abundance offers you, begins to release it in the world. And that can be done in home, in job, in all sorts of other places. And I hope we can look at some of those other places as we move along. One more, please, Rennie.
Well, in a sense, this release that Jesus calls for is calling for conversion, really, to a whole new order, a whole new way of life. And as we think of what would be a social order in which abundance, in which sharing, in which not worrying about, you know, or hoarding, that's a vision. And we can live it out in our individual lives, and I think it does call others. But at the same time, I think that this system, call it Pharaoh system, of scarcity, is highly organized and it's structural. So that my individual response has got to come up against the fact that the power is concentrated, it's structural, and I can make an individual decision, I can even form a community, but somehow, ultimately, I have to come to grips with the fact that we need to organize a response.
That's right. For me, the word organize is key.
So then I think you're talking about something that we Christians have a tough time with, which is we have to understand strategic theology. What's in the way of this vision? How will we get there?
I think that's right, and I think the case study that I'm going to move us to today actually provides us sort of an angle on that. It's not a perfect angle, to be sure, But the question is, as you know, as one begins to live out of the forgiveness of sins that has been offered, one encounters all of these places where the forgiveness of sins is not at work in the world. And then the calling of the Christian is, how do I concretely reorganize this part of life in response to what has been given to me? And then this part, and then this part. And I mean, it gets very complex because you can be pulled in all kinds of directions. And making choices is very difficult, and we end up finding out that we can't reorganize it all. And what do you do then? But I think you're right. There's a practical and strategic dimension to this. And I want this one human being's story to kind of get us into some of that, if it can. Anybody else, or shall we jump into?
Jump.
Okay. This is a very different kind of story about a doctor. Those of you who've had a chance to read it probably have not read an account of a doctor like this one. The author is named David Hilfiker, H-I-L-F-I-K-E-R. He has written a book called Healing Our Wounds, and this chapter is one that I took out of that book. I don't know, and in fact, one of the things he told me after I'd read this and I got so interested in him that I got in touch with him is that when he actually searched the medical literature for how many articles are there on mistakes that doctors make, he found only 3. And not a one of them was written by a doctor. Okay, so this was a very path-breaking piece. By the way, just so you get a sense of the courage of this man, the first place that he published this account was in the New England Journal of Medicine. Now, see, this is strategic theology, okay? He decided where the principalities and powers did their reading, and he decided, I'm going to put it there. The second place that he put this article was in Harper's, because he knew that there was a certain kind of audience that was much larger than modern medicine that he wanted to get at. Now, since some of you haven't read it, I'm going to sort of briefly take you through his story. It's a very painful story. It's a story of crisis in a human's life. It's a story of breakdown. It's a story of failure and guilt. And it's a story of incredible honesty. Hilfiker was a rural MD in a small town in Minnesota. And what he recounts here is really a series of major mistakes that he made, that's his word, in his practice. Now, without question, the most catastrophic mistake that he made is the one of the missed abortion. And those of you who have read it, maybe you could help me a little bit here. What struck you about this story? And maybe tell a little bit of it for those who are here who haven't had a chance to read it.
What struck me is how easily that mistake could be made just out of my recent experience with being pregnant and going out of the village early last summer to make sure that everything was okay. And that moment of relief when I saw the ultrasound and experience of a friend of mine who aborted a twin when she was away from her own obstetrician and called her own obstetrician who said, make sure they do an ultrasound before they do the DNC. So both of those make it seem to me that this mistake of not ordering an ultrasound, not checking what he thought were good results before he did this, is an easy mistake to make. But I don't think he's probably the only one who's ever made it.
All right. Well, as a matter of fact, I've my prior life, before I moved to Indianapolis, I worked for a number of years in the world of modern medicine, and I asked physicians, how unusual is this guy? And a number of them said, well, he's a much more tortured soul than many of us. He is a different kind of introspective person. But nonetheless, and this is what makes this an uncomfortable topic for us, is this is not an unusually bad doctor that you can all just dismiss because he's incompetent and you know he should be removed from practice. Doctors make these kinds of mistakes. And in this particular article, what we have is what seems to be a relatively simple mistake. He has that he does a certain kind of test on this patient, Barbara Daly. And each time the test results come back indicating that something is not right and that the pregnancy has come to an end. But yet this woman does not have a miscarriage, and so he's got a problem. And he even thinks about the ultrasound option, but because they live in a small town and because it's a family of limited means, and because he's really sure this is a relatively straightforward kind of thing, he opts not to have the ultrasound test done. And finally, what he does is he schedules Barb Daly, talks to her through this process, talks to her husband, Russ, through the process, but he schedules her for a D&C procedure to remove what he believes is a dead baby from her womb. And the passages in here where he's actually in the surgical procedure are just extremely painful. And whenever I use this material, I always have a kind of a fork in the road at that point. Do I read that material? And do we enter that pain, or do we skip over it? And I'm inclined to think that we need to read some of this. Let's look at page 75. This is what it's like to be caught in the middle of a serious mistake. He's into the procedure, and what is happening is he's beginning to remove parts of living tissue rather than dead tissue from the mom. I do my best to suppress my rising panic and try to complete the procedure. Working blindly, I am unable to evacuate the uterus completely. I can feel more parts inside but cannot remove them. I'm reading this far too calmly. This would be a scream in a man. Finally, I stop telling myself that the uterus will expel the rest within a few days. He goes on to describe how he dealt then with Russ. But the important sentence here is right at the middle of the page. Despite reassurances from a pathologist that it is impossible for a pregnant woman to have four consecutive negative pregnancy tests, the realization is growing that I have aborted Barb's living child. And what happens here is that what he had thought was a missed abortion, you know, that nature's natural way of doing things hadn't worked and he was sort of helping out, all of a sudden it becomes, I aborted. And so there's a tremendous guilt that begins to descend on this human being. Now what he does then is he goes on to talk after stark sentences like, you know, I've killed their baby. He begins to talk about a number of other mistakes that he made. And he actually offers, if you go through the article, a typology of mistakes that doctors make. There are some mistakes that you make because you don't have enough knowledge. There are some mistakes that you make because your technique is simply not advanced enough. Now, those are two different kinds of things. Then there are some others that are the result of simple carelessness. And then finally, there are some that are the result of a failure of will. And there he talks about being so fatigued and tired one day that he doesn't stop to deal with what he knows he ought to do with an elderly woman patient who's having chest pains. And he simply says, send her to my office, I'll be there in an hour and we'll take care of it. But the woman goes into cardiac arrest and dies. And what he begins to open up in this painful story is how every transaction with a patient has this risk of this kind of mistake in it. Every prescription, every surgical procedure, every office visit. Now, this is incredible candor to put all of this in the New England Journal of Medicine and in Harper's. And I, you know, we could spend our time just kind of going over the details of how awful these mistakes were and how much pain this human being was, but I want to move your attention just a little bit. What's going on here is that a physician has come clean about the dirty knowledge in his own profession. He has decided that he could go public and talk about the underside of his world. And in this case, the underside of his world is in his own heart. It's in his own head. It's the reality that he is responsible for. And I want now to point you to a couple of paragraphs where, instead of just keeping the spotlight on himself, he begins to turn the spotlight onto his profession and onto his society. And so look for a second on page 77. He's talking here about the problem of expectations of doctors. Doctors expect themselves to be perfect, he says, and their whole medical training, their socialization, all of it seeks to make them want and strive for a kind of perfection. But he says even more than that, our society wants our doctors to be perfect. And if you think about how you go to your doctor and what you expect from them, isn't it often a bit of perfection? Then look what he does in the middle of the page. This perfection, he says, is a grand illusion, of course, a game of mirrors that everyone plays. Doctors hide their mistakes from patients, from other doctors, even from themselves. Open discussion of mistakes is banished from the consultation room, from the operating room, from physicians' meetings. Mistakes become gossip and are spoken of openly only in court. And now, watch what comes next. Unable to admit our mistakes, we physicians are cut off from healing. We cannot ask for forgiveness, and we get none. We are thwarted, stunted, we do not grow. I want now, though, to move you to another page where his diagnosis continues, and that's on page 83. And this is the full paragraph. A physician is even less prepared to deal with his mistakes than is the average person. Nothing in our training prepares us to respond appropriately. As a student, I was simply not aware that the sort of mistakes I would eventually make in practice actually happened to competent physicians. As far as I can remember from my student experience on the hospital wards, the only doctors who ever made mistakes were the much maligned LMDs, that's what he was, local medical doctors. And then he goes on in that paragraph to really then talk about the whole ethos that he was socialized in. But what I want, I think, to just have us stop and pay attention to is that here is a doctor who, out of his own experience, looks at his profession and says, the profession is sick. Modern medicine is a patient in need of something really enormous. And what he finally does, if I can find the right page reference here, is he sums up his diagnosis this way. This is on page 85. The medical profession seems to have no place for its mistakes. Indeed, one would almost think that mistakes were sins. And if the medical profession has no room for doctors' mistakes, neither does society. The number of malpractice suits filed each year is symptomatic of this. In what other profession are practitioners regularly sued for hundreds of thousands of dollars because of misjudgments? The drastic consequences of our mistakes, the repeated opportunities to make them, the uncertainty about our culpability, and the professional denial that mistakes happen all work together to create an intolerable dilemma for the physician. We see the horror of our mistakes, yet we cannot deal with their enormous emotional impact. And now watch him turn and become a theologian for a second. Perhaps the only way to face our guilt is through confession, restitution, and absolution. Yet within the structure of modern medicine, there is no place for such spiritual healing. Now, what I think that Hilfiker has done in this piece, and I'd like to hear you talk about it a little bit, is he has talked about the most powerful profession in our country, and he has said that it has something right at its heart that is really wrong with it. And what he is crying out for here is a reorganization of that profession around the forgiveness of sins. That's what's going on in the article. Now, this article does not tell us how to do it, although some of his behaviors may give us some clues. But it's a diagnosis. It's a piece of powerful judgment about the way that we as a society are dealing with our problems of being ill and dying, and the way that the profession that is at the heart of that whole effort is acting. Now, I guess what I'd like to do is ask you what you think of that diagnosis. Maybe there's, was going to ask right when we started, is there a doctor in the house? Is there a physician here who would like to say this is not the way that world is, or who would say, yes, he's put his finger on something?
You might ask for nurses, Jim.
Well, we'll just keep widening the circle. What do you think about this diagnosis?
I think one of the things I'm struck by when I read through case study after case study that the case that he's talking about is the incredible aloneness with which he seems to face these problems. Mm-hmm. And even to the point of not including the clients in the decision or more parts of the team. There may be some other viewpoints, and I think that's where many physicians are, is that aloneness. And when you see them going through those day-to-day agonizing decisions, they feel like that's their thing, that they're supposed to do that in many instances. And yet, the physicians whom I know who open themselves up to examining it all are very. Go through agony daily, mm-hmm. because they know, they know the potential, and they talk about the potential. And we have a good friend who is an obstetrician who has gone through these kinds of things many times. And if only I had, and why didn't I do this? But not wanting to talk to his colleagues about it.
Yeah, it's like the last thing that you would do is admit it to a colleague. Mm-hmm. Partly because you're concerned that those colleagues may not refer future patients to you, but also just their estimation of you as a colleague.
But I just really think the tragedy is no sense of being part of a community that mm-hmm. can support you through that.
Well, and if we took that account of Jesus for a moment and said, I remember what he did in that miracle account, the first move he made after telling the disciples, you're going to do it differently, you're going to feed them, was to organize them into groups and community. There's a sign there for us about a need, and perhaps one of the things that modern medicine really needs is community. But maybe that's not just something modern medicine needs. Maybe that's something that the U.S. of A. needs. Okay, anybody else?
Well, what struck me particularly in the first account about the young couple that were pregnant, Sonia mentioned what really got me was that she felt pregnant. She herself knew, but the doctor kept telling her she wasn't. Mm-hmm. And that communication between patient and doctor, I think, is a lot of what's missing. Doctors are so busy and overwhelmed and tired and distraught that they don't have time. They've been given the power. The patient gives over their power to the doctor and believes what they say because they are supposed to be the authority. And if that communication between doctor and patient was more open.
Yeah. Number one cause of lawsuits is poor communication with patients.
Well, and what are those signs of? I mean, that's a sign that instead of it being a community of care, it's something else.
Right.
Something very important is missing. And so the question would be, how do you take a profession that is this technologically sophisticated, has this much specialization required to offer us all these goods, and how do you make a community of healing out of that? Yeah.
Jim, is this the same guy who wrote an article I read, I think somewhere in the New York Times Sunday edition years ago, called The Monetization of Medicine?
No, I don't think it is, but there's a similar thing here about what happens when a certain kind of economics takes right. over in all of this.
When you mentioned Hillbiker, I thought that's the guy's name, but it might not be okay. The guy who wrote that was eventually had moved to Washington, D.C. and was working in a your city.
Oh, well, then it is, and you've just swiped some of my thunder for later on. Go ahead.
You'll forget
go.
I ever mentioned yeah. That's about all I know.
And now I blew your wad.
All right. No, that's
fine. Yeah,
it is the guy. And in an interview that I did with him, he talks very clearly about the economic incentives and what that does to the breakdown of community in healthcare. He's very critical of it. And his way of responding was renunciation, finally. And we have to talk about whether that's the only response or the best response. But.
Well, one of the things I do in my profession is recruit physicians. And I've noticed quite a change in the last 5 years in terms of the person that comes out of medical school. There's definitely been a shift towards finding people that have a caring attitude rather than the highest MCAT scores. Mm-hmm. And I think that's real good. But on the downside, so I think the profession's recognized that. On the downside, it's still a penalty-driven kind of system. There is no, with one exception, I think the physician that is an abuser of alcohol or drugs, there's been some good things set up for healing. But, you know, for this whole issue of mistakes and judgment, it's miserable. Mm-hmm. And you're right, they go by it themselves. Mm-hmm. Unless, like you said, that person just happens to be an individual that has their own support network. And
please.
Well, we went to a medical co-op, and I probably all heard of group health for many years. And I think one of the good things about that, and I find many good things about it, is that the physicians make a conscious decision to go in there, and they work for a lot less money. Certainly they put in long hours like physicians do, but from a consumer standpoint, it sure seems like they've got a lot more time for me, the consumer. There's a lot more talk that seems to go on. You got a question, you are encouraged to call, no matter what time, and they really want to know everything that you know about them. And so, and they talk. They seem to talk back and forth. So, you know, maybe that is some of the type of community that is being built that's different from the, you know, the true private sector.
Well, I think if we would really look around, we'd find all kinds of attempts to address the breakdown of community and medicine problem. And the question we would have to ask is, which of these are merely rearranging the furniture on the deck of the Titanic, and which are ones that can really open up the possibility of better care for the physicians as well as for the people that they care for.
Yeah, I agree with this gentleman about the main cause, or one of the major causes, is lack of communication, but with the MD and the patient. And you see this often in big city practices where there are a lot of demands, and we're seeing patient loads of 100 or more a day. But in this case, it doesn't appear that's where the breakdown occurred. It appeared that there was exceptional communication, or at least confidence in him, which mm-hmm. is the mark of a small town doctor. It's the great bedside manner, and I think that this is borne out by the fact that they did not bring a medical malpractice lawsuit, and they had an excellent case. I think that here we're talking about they refer very negatively to the LMD, the local guy. He made a judgment here that finances were a problem. Did not even inform them that that they had an option of ultrasound. And I think that failure to disclose is because he knew too much. I mean, he obviously related to them to a point that he almost felt they couldn't afford that. That should not be an option for them, and made that judgment. And I think that wouldn't have happened in a big city. That testing, first of all, because you create more fees when you get tests. And that is one of the complaints about modern practices. You just get beat to death with all the tests. But that never would have happened in a major practice in a city where he would not have informed them that was an option and not had that test done, even if they didn't need it. It would have happened, I think. So, I think this is something that could easily happen in a small town practice where you just don't have the technology available to you.
He's out there by himself.
Involved, they have to send it to another city, and that's one of the problems with probably the little town with one GP that handles a lot of money.
Well, to not just make this about physicians, but to think about vocation generally, and one of the things that this case suggests to me is that when we think of vocation as this expansion or extension of the forgiveness of sins, we need to remember that we do that as disciples of the Christ, not as the Christ. And that if I think about my relationship with my doctor, one of the reasons that it works is that I don't expect her to get it right every time. I go back and say, gee, those painkillers really aren't working. I'm really still hurting. Let's try again. But that as a society, we do put physicians almost in the role of the Christ when it comes to our disease. Mm-hmm. And so it's very difficult for them to say, gee, I blew it, or I can't help you. That pain, there's nothing I can give you for that pain. You're just going to hurt. We can forgive people who we don't expect to be perfect more easily.
What I'd like to do, I thank you for trying to widen the conversation here. I mean, you could spend all of our time just talking about doctors and all of that. I chose this because it was at the epitome of our professional paradigm, and also because this person is so unbelievably candid about the dirty knowledge that he has to bear. And what I'd like to do, I hope we could have time for some small group conversations. We're not today. But I'd like you to think about not just the doctors, but the other places where this problem occurs, where there's no room for something very important to happen, and where people get really, really badly hurt. And so I thought of a series of questions that could lead you into an encounter with this no room problem in your own work world. Not just in the doctor's work world, but if it's in the classroom where you teach, if it's at home, where do you encounter places where there's no room for the kind of healing and the kind of facing of our failure and finitude to occur. And the questions I thought of were these. Where in your world of work do you experience or have you experienced the kind of pain that Hilfiker describes? The second one is, what do you do with the pain? Do you do the exact same thing Hilfiker does? I mean, I think of attorneys here, but I think also of folks who drive trucks. When something's going on in your work world that is exposing your failure, making you feel radically diminished, where is there room to talk about that and to address that? Third question would be, how could your work world, whatever it is, be reorganized to minister to that pain? What needs to happen? Hilfiker tries to get at some of that in his piece. He says, something is really missing. At least he tries to name what it is that's missing. And then finally, if you really were going to go about reorganizing to minister to that kind of pain, what does it take to do that? And this is getting into the question of strategy. How do you go about this kind of reorganizing? What are the things that need to be done? Now, let me just conclude. I'm going to take some of these questions up in our next session. But let me conclude by telling you the next chapter in David Hilfiker's life. He really did get to me with this article, and so since I was an editor of a journal, I decided I'm going to interview him and find out more about him. And so the interview is in this issue of Second Opinion, which is actually in the Holden Library here. And what happened with Hilfiker is he left his practice in Minnesota, and he moved to Washington, D.C., and he serves now at Christ House, which is a shelter for homeless men in our nation's capital. And he now does health care directly for those people. And I want to just read a comment or two from the interview, which will tell you why he made the change that he did. And that's fine if I can find the page number. I'm sorry that I scribbled this in the wrong place.
Yeah. Well, he's looking for that. Let me ask this gentleman, yep, your group that's interviewing doctors for John. Can I ask him a question?
Sure.
I know that the medical schools now, that what you're saying about the type of person they're looking for is very different. They want somebody that's a whole person as opposed to the technically competent person as number one. But they're also teaching, I understand, ethics a lot more in their medical
schools.
That's
right. Yes.
And do you know anything about, do they have any kind of coursework involved with dealing with these kinds of mistakes? What do you do?
I believe
develop
some,
a support group or something like that.
Right. I think some medical schools have gone that far. There's one. It might be Harvard that's really taken that to an extreme, and that's like the first course they take in the first year. And then it's repeated at the third year.
Well, part of their curriculum too has addressed the psychosomatic aspect of illness, mm-hmm, which has been, I mean, they've been the leading school in that regard, from what I understand.
I have a friend who was
The observation I was thinking about in this process that happened with the abortion thing was that, like when Joanne was talking about it, that she felt she was pregnant and this was her intuition. And they use mechanical means, they use the stuff of a scientific society to make the decision for them. And the doctor too, as he was reaching in there, I mean, he noticed that the womb had gotten larger right before he was about to do this, but he was so into relying on the mechanics of the society and his occupation to make decisions for him, that he overrode his own intuition, and so did she. They both, instead of being in touch with, and I think that culturally this shows up everywhere, that we rely upon things and stuff instead of our interconnection with each other, the relationships that we have. And I know that, I mean, in the smallest ways this will show up for me, even like, should I take the binoculars when I go out the door, and I logically override it because I know that I don't need them for what I have planned. And then I get there, and sure enough, there's something. Boy, I wish I had those binoculars.